In a video statement on Wednesday, Valencia says that the farmers and villagers of Ucario are the real victims and vulnerable to the attacks by armed groups. We now bring you the voices from the community of Ucario. These are voices that you're not going to hear anywhere else, as activists and supporters charge major Spanish language news outlets, namely Telemundo, with slanting their coverage towards the Mexican government propaganda as it pertains to this issue. The noise also in this clip that you're going to hear in the background is a rainstorm that did not deter the citizens of Ucario from making their demands known. And we seem to be having a little issue with that clip being brought up. Our board op for the revolution, Courtney, is going to be tackling that issue. But while we are trying to make sure that we get you those voices on the air, John, you have a... Oh, we do have it now. One second. Here are the voices of the citizens of Ucario, Michoacán, Mexico.
Many years ago, west of God, we're all using traffic. We want to meet you because the way that we were being confronted with on a daily basis, at least then, it was still somewhat politically oriented, whereas now I think it's just
And I'm sorry, for some reason we appear to be having background interference in that. Okay, I apologize for that while we try to get that issue settled. John, you have an announcement for this week.
Yeah, we have a couple of... important announcements. Tomorrow, the annual Pastors for Peace event here in Houston. Every year for the last 26 years or so, the Pastors for Peace caravan has been coming through Houston on its way to Mexico with goods that were raised, assembled here in the U.S. and Canada. Normally what's done is there are three departing points from different cities in the U.S. converging next week on the Mexican border in South Texas. But on the way, one of those caravans stops in Houston every year. And... the event is this Saturday at 5 p.m., give or take. The event this year is going to be held at the Fiel office, and that is, I'm trying to get the address for it, but information can be had by calling 281-732-7106 or 713-506-2633. What you can do to help is, I know the school supplies has always been something that is needed. So if you come tomorrow,
And that is going to be at 6610 Harwin.
Okay.
That is in the Gulfton neighborhood.
Right. Now, we did confirm that's where it's going to be.
Well, you said the Fiel offices.
That's
where they're located.
So, but before folks head out that way, or if they have any other questions, would suggest they call the two numbers that I listed. But minor medical supplies is always useful. I know in the past they've collected wheelchairs, if you've got wheelchairs and walkers. So that's tomorrow at about 5 p.m. at the Fiel office.
On Harwin. Okay, and
yes.
Now we are ready with the voices from Ucario, Michoacán, Mexico, and the Popular People's Uprising against corruption that took place there and has been taking place there for the last week.
We need help. We want the media to come. We are alone and forgotten here. There are no police, nobody. We need soldiers' help. Excuse me, I don't know how to talk. I don't know anything about him, and I don't know anything outside of what our town needs and what is happening here in our land and in our town of Tico. They have to support us directly with everything necessary to keep moving forward out of this problem that we are complaining about here. We have to get the support of the government. We already know, like patrols or the army, so that we do not have to defend ourselves as citizens. We are ready to take this as far as we need to and face the consequences, because we are already starting to organize ourselves right now. You aren't armed? No, we're not armed. Nobody here has any arms. The only arms we have are the ones on our bodies. Are you tired of the crime? Yes. The police aren't helping us at all. Nobody from the government. Nobody at all. We are here alone, forgotten. We are forgotten completely. We are forgotten completely by them. We are demanding that they help us in one form or another.
No hay nadie. Están solos.
Here there are only barricades. There's not any police at all, not from the state, not from the local government, not from the army, and not any of the federal police. There's nobody here. We are by ourselves. We have furniture and other odds and ends, and that's all we have to stop somebody from entering. It's our only defense. You just have to push these tires. Is there any more commentaries? Support, water. Yes, if someone can please send water. Now is the time. Look, even the weather's bad, and that isn't going to stop Unicario Michoacán to organize itself against the organized crime and also against the crime of indifference. We don't have police. We're tired. We want another type of government that knows how to take care of its people.
Muchas gracias.
And once again, that was brought from Michoacán in the town of Ucario in Michoacán, Mexico. As I had mentioned, the three people that were previously detained allegedly for charges stemming from killing kidnappers that were among the people that were terrorizing that community, those people have been released. So we are very happy for that. Regarding the other calling that the community and the other demands that they're making regarding getting support for preventing that community of farmers and villagers from continuing to be exploited and terrorized by various organized gangs and narco traffickers, that remains to be seen, and we will absolutely continue to follow that story. Also, this past Tuesday marked the 15th anniversary of the death or the state-sanctioned murder of Shaka Sankofa, or Gary Graham. As George Bush was amidst his first run for the White House, he was also working at warp speed, signing state-sanctioned murders at an unparalleled rate in a state that already had the distinction of being the busiest death row in the nation. Courtney's going to be working right now to get Lily Hughes on the line. And so we're going to be looking at, first of all, look back at the case of Gary Graham or Shaka Sankofa, which leading up to his execution, he had a lot of international support, among whom were notables such as Coretta Scott King and Desmond Tutu. Lily Hughes is going to be with us tonight, and she's joining us from the campaign to end the death penalty. First of all, to look back and also to look at whether we've made any progress in the 15 years since that happened. Lily, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. Of course, just to kind of start off, we do have some listeners maybe who aren't as familiar with that case. Shaka Sankofa, otherwise known as Gary Graham, is at the time of his arrest, was charged with murder after, by his own admission, being on a robbery spree and also raping a woman. This mm-hmm. hardly really makes him a likable person in the eyes of the jury, which is not something they're necessarily supposed to take into account. But what role did you think that this played in his initial conviction for capital murder and his ultimate execution?
Well, I would say that it was very easy for the prosecution to pin this murder on him because of the activities that he had been involved in. But unfortunately, the evidence just wasn't there to support his murder conviction. The other thing I want to say right from the outset is that Shaka was 17 years old when he was arrested. And in this day and age, he would not have been executed under the law. He would have not been eligible for the death penalty now that that has been outlawed. So he was 17, and like you said, he was involved in this crime spree. But this murder that they convicted him and sent him to death row for is not something that he was involved in. And, when we started working on the case, of course, we did we were one among many groups who supported and worked together to support Shaka, including the death penalty abolition movement there in Houston, and other family members and people that were close to Shaka who were very involved in his campaign. But we quickly read about how he was convicted based solely on the testimony of a one eyewitness. And this eyewitness was in a car several feet away from him in a supermarket parking lot in the dark, but was on the stand saying that she believed that he was the man that she saw. But there was no physical evidence that connected him to the shooting. There was also several alibi witnesses, some who passed polygraph tests, saying that Shaka was with them at the time. And so that was what he was convicted on. Very, very flimsy evidence. Then we also have to say that racism certainly played a case or, a part in his conviction as well. A young black man, as we know in Texas, statistically or anywhere, statistically, if you are black and being accused of murder, then you're much more likely to be for the prosecutor to ask for the death penalty in your case. So.
And also, you did mention that Shaka was 17 at the time of his arrest. And, of course, just listeners, I also want to make the distinction. It wasn't that Texas all of a sudden changed the law. That was actually a Supreme Court decision and one of the victories Correct. That's happened since Shaka's unfortunate state-sanctioned murder, and the fact that we no longer can put juveniles on death row. But that was not a Lone Star State decision. That was a decision from on high. So... Now, you did go into some of the problems of the case, and I understand, obviously, that you were able to very much be involved in, along with several other organizations, as you previously mentioned, in trying to save Shaka Sankofa's life. How were you able to get past the crime spree and get past those things and build such a large coalition? Because it wasn't just longtime abolition activists such as yourself and such as those involved in the Texas death penalty abolition movement, but there were a lot of people that were very much involved in this case and outside of the death house in Huntsville on the day back in 2000, advocating for a last minute stay.
Yes, that's right. I think it was 2,000 people outside the death house protesting on the night of his execution. But that was just the night of the execution. There was a lot of protest and activism that came before that. And it's hard to say why a certain case clicks. But I think we can say one thing that is important is the involvement of the prisoner fighting for themselves and as well as their family members. And so Shaka's mother, was very involved and very outspoken in speaking on his behalf. But also Shaka was a very political, very revolutionary person who took the lead in the campaign to stop his own execution, who really reached out to a lot of people and built a lot of relationships during his incarceration that I think helped him later as we, were building the campaign to stop his execution. And so I think that's a really important part of it, is the way that Shaka organized from behind the walls, and the support of his mother and his family, which was just vital. But also, I think the case alone, the evidence being just so, so flimsy, and there being so much evidence to show that he was innocent, and also at that time, the attention really being paid to the question of innocence. You have the Innocence Project, coming out with, getting some of their big wins at that time around DNA testing. And innocence was sort of at the forefront of discussions around the death penalty. And so I think, Shaka's case being so seemingly clear-cut as to his innocence, I think that really, played a role in getting a lot of people to look at his case and think here is a major injustice, and, not wanting to see that execution go forward.
And you did mention, obviously, DNA evidence. And while maybe it's not at the forefront or not as prevalent in the headlines as it was in 2000, we have had 15 exonerations in Texas over the past several years. And the most recent headline in celebration was when exoneree Anthony Graves held his former district attorney that prosecuted his case accountable and ultimately won against him. And so can you talk a little bit about that and maybe some of the other victories that we've seen in the 15 years since Shaka's death?
Well, yeah, we've had losses. We've had victories. I'd say the very most recent one was Alfred Wayne Brown, who came off of death row just last month, or, maybe it's a couple months ago now. But will likely win full exoneration and be eligible for compensation. So that's just the most recent exoneration. Obviously, another case that we were very involved in was the Kenneth Foster campaign, where we were able to win a commutation of Kenneth's sentence from death row to life in prison. Not life without parole, but life in prison, and we hope that he will have a chance, to get out of prison because of not having that without parole sentence. So those are, I think, some of the bigger victories: Anthony, Alfred, and Kenneth. But there have been other changes, I think, in the way that the death penalty operates now. I think last month there was the first person to be sentenced to death in Texas so far this year, and the number of people being sentenced to death has dropped precipitously in the last 3-4 years in particular. So just people aren't being sent to death row anymore. Many more cases are winning stays or, getting a chance to be reexamined. So there's definitely something that's happening even in Texas, which is still the most active execution chamber in the United States. There is still a lot of progress that's being made here.
Excellent. And one of the issues I know, just coming from, I moved here in 2000, and I moved here from the Northeast. And one of the things that just really kind of boggled my mind as I, sort of acclimated to my new adopted state was this whole thing of the law of parties, which essentially says that if you are in the act of committing a felony and someone dies as a result of that felony, particularly if it was violent in nature like a robbery, it doesn't matter whether you were waiting in the getaway car or actually pulling the trigger. You can both be charged and ultimately sent to death row for that crime. Can you explain if this is one of the things that you are putting particularly emphasis on as far as trying to win the small battles in the buildup to ultimately abolishing state-sanctioned murder here in Texas? And if not, what is your strategy for building anti-capitalist punishment movement further?
Yeah, I would say yes, we're definitely, that was the law that sent Kenneth Foster to death row. And it's more insidious than even how you discussed it, because the law says that you don't even have to, it doesn't have to be premeditated. You don't even have to be aware that a murder was going to take place. It says that you just should have anticipated that it might happen, you know, based on your activities. And in some cases, it's been applied to people that weren't even, you know, that maybe were in a car several feet away or outside a building, who had no knowledge that a crime like that was going to occur, and it, you know, has been applied to them. So that's definitely, especially after working on the Kenneth Foster campaign, that's definitely something that we are looking at. We're working on cases like Jeff Wood, and other log parties cases, and then also, of course, continuing to go to the legislature, try to get that law changed so that the death penalty is not an option in sentencing for people convicted under that law. So that's definitely a part of what we're working on. But I would say it's not the only part of our struggle. Our struggle still, at least for the campaign to end the death penalty, and for many of the our allies and our fellow abolitionists, the strategy that we're working on is still very similar to when we were trying to save Shaka, which is that by highlighting these cases, by highlighting Shaka's case and having it go national the way that it did, in the same way that cases like Troy Davis in Georgia or Santucky Williams in California, in the same way that those cases went national and even international, they shine a spotlight on the way the death penalty operates. And I think Shaka's case shone a spotlight on the way the death penalty operated in Texas, and that, you know, that made a huge difference in the way that people perceived it here, and support went down. And then, you know, by working on those cases like Shaka's, it humanizes the issue for people. They have to think about these people behind death row, who, you know, behind the walls on death row, who might be innocent or might have other, you know, factors in their cases. They might have been juveniles, or they may be mentally ill or have mental retardation. And all those things are things that we can highlight through working on these cases.
Thank you. And I know you mentioned Jeff Wood, and I know there that is a law of parties issue, because he was actually waiting out in the car. And I believe there is also some IQ questions stemming from that particular issue or that particular case. But can you highlight for listeners some other current cases that you would encourage them to get involved in, educate themselves on, or also any other resources for how they can get more involved and learn more about the abolition movement in general?
Yes, I would mention, of course, the Rodney Reed case. He was very close to execution last February before he won his stay, and the, you know, high courts are going to, or the Texas, you know, Court of Criminal Appeals is in the process of reexamining some of the evidence in his case, but there's still a campaign that we're building around that. Also, Luis Castro Perez, who is, you know, could be looking at an execution date being set any day. We believe that he is an innocent man on Texas death row. Other cases like the case of Paul Story, I would recommend people look him up. Also, Rob Will. I mean, there's just many, many cases. I think that the ones we're most active around right now are Rodney's case and Lewis's case. But if you go to nodeathpenalty.org, which is our national website, you can read a lot more about Rodney, and you can sort of go to the Get the Facts and look at some of the stuff that we're doing. But I would also suggest that people go to the marchformoratorium.org page and start thinking about the annual March to Abolish the Death Penalty, which will be happening in October 24th this year in Austin, Texas. And you can, you know, find out information there about many of the organizations that are sponsoring that march, links to their pages, and you can also find out about more of what we're doing in Texas at our Facebook page. It's the Campaign to End the Death Penalty - Austin, and we also have a page for Rodney Reed, which is We Demand Justice, Free Rodney Reed. And if you're on Facebook and you're looking around, you can find us that way as well.
Okay, thank you. And just very quickly, we have about 3 minutes left in the interview. One of the other topics that I'm just kind of wondering about, of course, there is also this issue that has come up, and it's also something more kind of pressure from overseas in the fact that the manufacturing company in Europe that makes many of the drugs that are utilized or have historically been utilized in capital punishment, they've pretty much refused to make it. So what impact do you think that is going to have moving forward?
Well, we hoped it would have, we were really hopeful that the recent case that the Supreme Court was looking at, which was Richard Glossop out of Oklahoma, challenging the use of midazolam, which is one of the drugs that states are being able to obtain from pharmacies, local compounding pharmacies, and that kind of thing. We were hoping that maybe the Supreme Court would rule against the use of that drug based on its role in a couple of botched executions. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court did not rule in our favor and said that it was okay for Oklahoma to go forward using that drug. Now, in Texas, there is an issue, too, in obtaining drugs, and we have been getting them from one of these compounding pharmacies, they're called, which are local pharmacies. And those pharmacies, though, don't want to have their names disclosed, and there has been some struggle in the legislature about whether or not those pharmacies should be forced to disclose their names, which now they are supposed to under, like, Freedom of Information Act or and those kinds, or, like, public safety laws, and the legislature is wanting to change that. But I think that while the difficulty in obtaining drugs is making some impact and is a good thing, it's still important to hammer on the larger issue of lethal injection itself. I did write an article about this for, I can't remember the title of it right now. I think it was called Killing the Death Penalty, and it was at jacobin.org. And one of the things I discovered researching that is that lethal injection is actually one of the most mistake-prone methods of execution thus far. So it's not a more humane method, and even the way that it was introduced first in Oklahoma, if people read about the way that it was introduced, I think you'll find that not very much research went into this method of execution. So I think for us it's to say that lethal injection is not a better way, but ultimately there is no better way. There is no way to execute people. It is always cruel and unusual, and it should be abolished completely.
Okay, thank you, Lily. Once again, we had Lily Hughes from the Campaign to End the Death Penalty. I really encourage you guys to Google Campaign to End the Death Penalty. They have a lot of resources. They've been on the ground doing this work for a long time. And also, that does it for our show this week. I'd like to thank Courtney, our board op for the revolution. Also, John, for being in the studio with me this evening. I am Rachel. I'm signing off, reminding everyone out there, don't hate the media, be the media. Peace.
Nothing defines summer like the sweet taste of watermelon, and no party will be sweeter than the 29th annual Watermelon Dance and Summer Social, a KPFT benefit held July 25th at the Last Concert Cafe, located at 1403 Nant Street. From noon until about 3 o'clock, the Clear Lake School of Rock performs. After that, Guitar Dave, Midnight Eyes, Charles Bryant, Jimmy's Junkyard, the Atomic Nightingales, Q&A, Robin Kirby, the Eric Demmer Band, Locate the Band, Helena Bucket, the Hightailers, Annie B. Band, Manila Whale, Pot Roast, and Drum Circle, along with belly dancing from the Tribal Lilies, will all take place. I'd like to thank our sponsors, Tracy Walker, State Farm Agent, listener member Andy Upshaw, and the Law Office of Aaron Weinman, and Trader Joe's, donating the other red meat, watermelon. Until 2:30, cover is $10. After that, it's $20 for one, $30 for two, with door proceeds benefiting your